Luke 4:5-4:8. The 18th talk in a series on the Gospel of Luke was presented by Jack Crabtree on April 25, 2004 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2004. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
All right, we're on page 10 of the Gospel, my translation of the Gospel of Luke, which amounts to, if you want to follow along in your Bibles, we'll be on in chapter 4 about verse 5. But before I get to that, I want to review what we looked at last week. We're in the temptations of Jesus, and we looked at in the order that they occur in Luke, we looked at the first temptation last week. I'm going to look at the second temptation this week. But let me review just briefly what we looked at with respect to the first temptation. Satan's goal in the temptation, I think, is to render unrighteous the one who God sent into the world to be the righteous king over the eternal kingdom of God. And by rendering him unrighteous, he would disqualify him from serving as that king, and in so doing would thwart or at least seriously damage the purposes of God. And as I have suggested, that may be the only thing Satan ever hopes to do, is to simply be a pain in the neck. What is his strategy in this temptation? It's to look at the circumstances in which Jesus is in. He's hungry, very, very possibly on the threshold of death by starvation. That's possible. In any case, he has this very, very compelling physical desire, need that is not being met. And Satan is pointing to the circumstances as evidence that God is not good, that he's attempting to promote in Jesus distrust for God and even anger toward God, feeling sorry for himself. And he does so by reminding him that of all the people in the world who ought to be taken care of by God, it's him, Jesus, because he is, after all, the Son of God. And he's seeking to drive a wedge between Jesus and Jesus' Father, trying to make it seem eminently rational that Jesus should take care of himself because God's goodness doesn't seem to be adequate to move God to do it. The deception in Satan's suggestion, there are basically three false things that are implied or suggested by Satan. The first, I argued, is that Jesus, as the Son of God, has the authority in himself to eliminate the suffering that he is in. I argued that I don't think he did. I don't think he could have turned the stones into bread. Secondly, Jesus, as the Son of God, has the right inherently to be taken care of in a way and in terms that are meaningful to him. I think Jesus recognizes that's not true. And thirdly, that God is not adequately good, or at least God's goodness is not of any benefit to him. And again, that's false, and I think Jesus knows that that's false. Why would following Satan's advice have been a sin on Jesus' part? According to God's purposes and his creation, the focus of my existence as a human being and any human being's existence is rightfully to have God's will for my life played out in my life. That's the focus of my existence. That's what gives meaning and significance to it. So the only righteous orientation that a human being can have is toward the sentiment that God's will be done. Any other orientation would be unrighteous. It would be to forsake the very point and meaning of my existence. So the orientation that Satan is suggesting, namely that at all costs I must eat and live, is an unrighteous orientation. And Jesus recognizes that and reminds himself of that. Then to review what I think we can learn from the temptation, Jesus is a unique human being. We're not Jesus. On occasions when my life experience is not what I want it to be, when I am being deprived of what I want or need, or when I am suffering in some way, I will frequently be tempted to conclude that God is not good, or that God's goodness is of no benefit to me, or that God does not have my best interest in mind. And in that instance, we need to heed Jesus' example. Specifically, Jesus knew that the righteous disposition was to accept God's will for his life, even if that meant suffering, deprivation, or even death. Second thing we can learn, on those same occasions, when my life experience is not what I want it to be, when I'm being deprived or when I want of what I want or need, or when I'm suffering, I will frequently be tempted to believe that God owes it to me to take care of me in a way that I can understand, that is, in a way that I want to be taken care of. And again, we should follow Jesus' example. Jesus, the human being who deserved good treatment above any other human being who has ever existed, did not presume to deserve anything from his Father. Instead, he accepted from God whatever God had ordained for him. Thirdly, I will often find myself tempted to view the purpose of my existence to be something other than my playing out the story that God wants to tell in my life and existence. That is, that the purpose of my existence is food or pleasure or happiness or anything else. And here again, we need to heed Jesus' example. Specifically, Jesus was unwaveringly committed to the truth that the purpose of his existence was to do the will of his Father, and that the meaning of his existence was to have the will of his Father played out in his life. And then finally, I will often find myself tempted to believe the lie that I have the power and authority to take care of myself in the way that I want to be taken care of. In other words, I will be tempted to believe the lie that I have the power and authority to thwart or circumvent the sovereign will of God. Jesus recognized that such a belief was false, a lie, and we need to recognize that as a lie as well. Okay, I reviewed all that because when we come to the second temptation, I think it's critical that we understand everything that Satan has suggested in the first temptation is still on the table when we get to the second temptation. So part of the second temptation and the dynamic of it includes everything that we've already explored in the first one. So let's read the second temptation. It's paragraph 46 on my translation, 5 through 8 of chapter 4 of Luke. He also led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in that moment of time. And the devil said to him, I will give you authority with respect to all of this, even the glory of these kingdoms, for it has been handed over to me, and I can give it to whomever I want. Therefore, if you will bow down before me, it shall all be yours. But Jesus responded to him and said, it is written, you shall bow down to the Lord your God and serve only him. Okay, first question, it says, he also led him up. There's some ambiguity here. Who's the he that is leading him up? By the time we finish the whole story of all the temptations, and if we include what Matthew says in his Gospels, it becomes clear that it's Satan who led him up. It was the Spirit of God who led him into the wilderness, but from once he got into the wilderness, the he is Satan throughout here. So it's the devil or Satan who led him up. Matthew says led him up onto a very high mountain. And I think that explains this language that Luke uses to lead him up because the devil is taking him to the top of some peak. He led him up and showed him all the kingdoms of the world in that moment of time. Well, what is he talking about? First of all, what does he mean by world? Matthew, I believe it is, uses the word cosmos in Greek. And as you may know, cosmos is a very ambiguous term. It can mean a lot of different things. And it can mean anything from what we mean by the whole cosmos to actually the order of service that you use when you're making a sacrifice at the temple. I mean, anything that has been ordered and structured and is law-driven and rule-driven and has rational structure to it is a cosmos. One of the ways in which it can be used is the world of the Roman Empire of that day. Luke uses a different word, and the word that he uses, in my judgment, is more likely to refer to the Roman Empire of this time, basically the empire that exists. So I think that's what Satan is offering him. He took him up to show him all the vast reaches of the Roman Empire. And the way he did that is he took him up to a high mountain. So I think all Jesus is seeing is the horizon. And he's taken up to this high mountain in order to get some perspective. Satan is in effect saying to him, I have authority over everything as far as your eyes can see. And you're familiar with Rome. I mean, Rome, who's in control, my puppet, Rome has control over all of this. And I'll give it to you if you'll simply bow down to me. He uses this phrase that's a little bit difficult to understand or translate, but I translate it in that moment of time. I think the point that is being made here is that he's saying, if you understand the history of the Roman Empire, Rome really was a remarkable phenomenon. It started just this little city-state of kind of renegades and, you know, kind of an eclectic Australian-type fugitives and prisoners and stuff like that. And it started off this little tiny city-state and over the course of time grew into one of the largest empires the world has ever known. An amazing story. Well, we're at the apex of their glory about now. And Satan is taking him and saying to Jesus, who has to be familiar with the reach of Rome around the globe, the known globe, the civilized world, he's saying to him, at this point in time, there it is. It's all under Rome, and I'll give it all to you. When it says he showed him all the kingdoms of the world, there are commentators that look at this and treat it as if the devil has taken Jesus up to a high mountain and given him a PowerPoint presentation. Now here's the gates of Babylon. Look how beautiful they are. Look how glorious they are. And here's Rome. Isn't that a big building? And just simply pointing out all the virtues of this empire and the glories of the world. But I don't think so. I mean, I think a lot of this stuff is known to Jesus, at least indirectly, if not directly. But what is being seen is simply the vast reaches. How many people and how much land and how much territory is included in the reach of Rome that is going to be offered to Jesus. And it's at this point in time, because as we know, Rome eventually fell apart. But at this point in time, Rome controls the world. So the devil said to him, I will give you authority with respect to all of this, even the glory of these kingdoms. Okay, well, the first question is, he will give him authority with respect to all of this. Does Satan have authority over all of that? I think the answer to that is basically, yes, he did. In Ephesians, Paul at one point calls Satan the, what's he call him? What is it? The prince of the power of the air. And at another point, I think he's called the god of this world. And he's described in both ways. And particularly at this point in time, Satan holds sway in the world. Now what does that mean? I think largely what that means is the lies, the deceptions, the foolishness promoted by Satan is what holds sway over every civilization over the course of time. I've talked about this before, but it seems to me that when the apostles talk about Jesus being the light coming into the world, they're not just talking about something that's relevant to us as individuals, but they're talking about something that actually happened in history. And I think that historians could show you significant shifts in history that happened because of the advent of Christianity. When Jesus came into the world, civilization like we had never known it came into the world. Humanity like we had never known it came into the world. In the sense of humaneness came into the world. That with Jesus came a kind of hipness and enlightenment to what it means to be a human being that had been completely unknown to the ancient world, with its cruelty, with its power struggles, with its feuds, with its unmerciful behavior toward one another. And with respect to religion became considerably more rational after Jesus came than it had been before. It had been very, very superstitious paganism. And I have argued, I think, not understandably, because the powers of darkness were at work in the world up until Jesus came to a degree that we have never experienced. Perhaps even to the extent of going into a pagan temple and having this stone statue talk to you. Well, who wouldn't believe that that's a god if that stone statue can talk to you? But I think what happened with the coming of Jesus is, as Jesus put it once to his disciples, I saw Satan falling from the heavens like lightning. That Jesus recognized that one of the things that God was going to do with his advent, with his coming into the world, is he was going to tie the hands of Satan. He was going to muzzle him to a certain extent and utterly impede his power and authority to deceive the world. He was in a sense dethroned, not altogether. I mean, he's still present. It was that his activity was not stopped. It was simply curtailed. But his activity was curtailed with the coming of Jesus. Well, it hasn't been curtailed yet. This is the before, not the after. And so when Satan comes to him and says, I have authority of all this, that's true. He does have authority over all this. But it's only half true what he's saying, because he goes on to say, I will give you authority with respect to all of this, even the glory of these kingdoms, for it has been handed over to me, and I can give it to whomever I want. Well, that's the lie, I think. Whether we're talking about a human being who has power and authority in this world, or whether we're talking about the devil or Satan who has authority in this world, no one has the authority to grant authority to everyone else except God, the sovereign God who in his providence controls all of human history. It's God who puts the President of the United States in his position. It's God who puts a king in his throne. God elects whoever he wants to elect, and nobody can thwart the purposes of God. Only God can enthrone Jesus as his king. And so Satan's lying to him when he is suggesting that he could enthrone him as king. He says then, therefore, if you will bow down before me, it shall all be yours. Now, on the one hand, if we don't, there's two ways we can look at this. We could look at this as saying, look, if you'll just change sides and stop being a follower of God and become a follower of me, I'll give you all this and, you know, together we'll rule, we'll rock, you know, together. You could do that. I mean, you could read it that way. But if you were to read it that way, it's not very tempting, I think. Certainly not to Jesus. I mean, Jesus has already shown his regard for his Father and his understanding of who he is in relationship to God. I think what makes a whole lot more sense is that this is an attempt by Satan to present what he's asking, the condition that he's putting on his turnover of power to Jesus, to be a relatively trivial sort of thing. I think in effect what he's asking is, look, you love God and you want to serve God and you want to obey God, and God has promised you that you will be King of Kings and Lord of Lords one day, that you're going to be the everlasting king over his kingdom. And I know that's your destiny. But you're out here in the wilderness and you don't have anything to eat, Jesus. I think we can see, God has already demonstrated that the path to your destiny from God's perspective is a path of suffering, is a path of sorrow and a path of pain. We could short circuit all that, Jesus. I'm the enemy. I'm the one in power right now, but I'm willing to relinquish all of my power and authority over the world to you. I'm just asking one silly cotton picking thing. No big deal. Just 10 seconds. Just give me 10 seconds where you bow your forehead to the ground and show me some respect. For just 10 seconds of respect, I'll call it good and you can be king. That's all it takes. So you got your Father who's going to take you through near starvation and who knows what other suffering may lay ahead for you, Jesus. I don't think, as I suggested on Easter, I don't think Satan knows about the cross. I don't think Satan knows how tempting his temptation is, because I don't think he's hip to everything that that Jesus is going to have to go through. But he does know that the way of obedience to him is going to be a road of suffering for Jesus. He does know that. So Jesus, you can get the kingdom by doing it God's way, and you'll have to suffer, or you can get the kingdom easy, quick and easy, my way. Just show me a little respect and it's yours. Well, you know, you and I put in the same position. I mean, that's an incredibly attractive offer. But Jesus rightly understands what's really going on, and we need to explore that. Jesus responded to him, and remember, in every one of these cases, when it says Jesus responded to him, he's not really responding to Satan. This is not a duel between Jesus and Satan. He's responding to him only in the sense that he's making a response to what Satan has suggested. But his response is to remind himself of the truth. Jesus needs to fortify himself with respect to what is true in order to repel and avoid the lie, the folly of Satan suggested. So he fortifies himself with the truth, going to Deuteronomy, quoting a passage out of Deuteronomy and reminding himself of what it says there. It is written, he says, you shall bow down to the Lord your God and serve only him. Okay, this is not actually a verbatim quote from Deuteronomy. I think Jesus has kind of adjusted the quote to fit his own circumstances. There's nothing about bowing down in Deuteronomy. Jesus is interpreting Deuteronomy to apply to bowing down. But he's following very closely the point, the gist of a passage in Deuteronomy 6:13. And let's turn there and look at that. Deuteronomy 6. I'm going to look at the first 19 verses here. Now, remember what Deuteronomy is. Deuteronomy is basically this last kind of exhortation and sermon that Moses is preaching to the nation of Israel before they leave him behind and enter into the promised land. It's a very, very interesting book. So Moses is saying, now this is the commandment, the statutes and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you, that you might do them in the land where you are going over to possess it. That's the promised land. So that you and your son and your grandson might fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments which I command you all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. O Israel, you should listen and be careful to do it, that it may be well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your might. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Then it shall come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and hewn cisterns which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied. Then watch yourself, that you do not forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery. You shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. That's the part that Jesus is reminding himself of. You shall not follow other gods, any of the gods of the peoples who surround you. For the Lord your God in the midst of you is a jealous God. Otherwise, the anger of the Lord your God will be kindled against you, and he will wipe you off the face of the earth. Actually, we'll stop there. Okay, I think to understand what Jesus is saying and what he's reminding himself of, we need to understand what Moses is saying there. Some of this is going to be review for some of you, but it's a crucial piece to understand. So let me bear with me if you will. I think we have to understand what it means for a God to be a God. You know, for us, God is just a word. It's not a concept, I don't think. It's almost like a name that we use to refer to the main character of the Bible. But it doesn't really have any conceptual content for most of us. But as I've looked more at the polytheism of Egypt and Babylon and Greek and the Greece and Rome and the ancient world, it becomes more and more apparent to me that the name God has a concept to it. A God is a force within reality that shapes the course of our lives. You know, a God is that which brings a tornado when a tornado comes, or a hurricane when a hurricane comes, or a famine when a famine comes, or fertility so that I can have children, and fertility for my crops so that my crops will grow. Everything that impinges on my life and determines whether I will prosper or not prosper, succeed or not succeed, all those factors that shape our lives are shaped by forces and realities that transcend what we can see and what we can know directly with our own eyes. There are all these invisible realities that determine the outcome. Well, what is an invisible reality that determines the outcome of our lives? A God. That's what it is. Now, in the ancient world, their worldview was that you have several independent gods. That is to say, several independent forces or realities at work to change the course of history and to change the course of my individual life. So there was the God of love, and there was the God of war, and there was the God of money, and the God of sex, and the God of this, and the God of that. There are all these different gods, all of them operating independently, having a will of their own, if you will. And so our lives, then, are simply the collision, and the course of my life is the net result of the collision of all of the wills of these gods, or to translate it, the net result of all these forces independently coming to bear on my existence. Well, understandably, in the ancient world, you lived in a little bit of fear. You were a little paranoid because life was a little chaotic and a little out of your control. And the only way you could bring any control in your life is to keep as many or all of those gods happy with you, on your side, if you will, inclined to give you favors rather than not, as you can. When you get to Rome, you have the Romans sacrificing, worshiping, and serving hundreds of gods, if not thousands. I mean, it was absurd. It was just ridiculous. What's so revolutionary, what's so radical about the biblical worldview is the Bible comes along and introduces us to the truth, the reality, the fact that there really is only one person, one force, one will who controls my life, the course of my life and my destiny. Now, granted, there are other secondary gods, if you will. There are other forces in my life, economics, politics, social forces of one kind or another, that are out of my control, and they do impinge on my life. So it's really not the biblical view that there don't exist other gods. Other gods do exist. That's true, if you understand what gods means. But the biblical perspective is not that they don't exist. The biblical perspective is that they don't count. The biblical perspective is none of them operate independently of the one and only reality-shaping force that has any ultimate say in the course of my life. And that is the God who revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The God who appeared to Moses at Mount Sinai and said, when asked to give his name, I am he who is. That is, God has being and existence that is unparalleled, unmatched by anything that is in this world. We only are by the will of God, but God just is by the will of no one. God just simply exists and has existence in and of himself. A radical idea in the ancient world. No one had conceived of such a thing. So this God comes and introduces himself to Moses and then says to Israel, you should do business with nobody but me. And why? I mean, what's the rationale behind that? Because no one else has any say on the course of your life but me. Other things may seem to have some say about how your life is going to go, and they do, but only because I have willed it. Only because I have directed it, only because I have guided economics and politics and social forces to go the way that they will go. But the one who's ultimately willing your life to be on the course that it's on is me. So you need fear, you need have regard for no one but me. I'm the one that you want to have happy with you. I'm the one that you want to be on good terms with. No one else matters. So that's what he's saying here in Deuteronomy when he says, you shall fear only the Lord your God, and you shall worship him and swear by his name. He had just finished saying, you know what's going to happen? Or he's warning them, when you go into the land, here's what's going to happen. God is going to chase out the Canaanites in front of you. And it's going to leave behind their houses and their vineyards and their cisterns, and all the comforts of home are going to be abandoned by them and be yours. Their cistern is your cistern now. Their olives are your olives. Their figs are your figs. You can partake of the abundance of the land as if it were yours. But watch out lest you forget why those gifts were given to you. Those gifts were given to you by Yahweh, your God. Don't you dare forget that. And I'll come back to this in a second, but the tendency of us as human beings is to take the blessings that the one and only God, the one and only reality-shaping force, sends our way and gives to us and blesses us with, and then we turn around and say, I did that. I achieved that. I obtained that. I'm responsible for the goodness of my life and the abundance of my life. And Moses is warning them, don't you dare think that. In their case, it wasn't so much I did that as some other gods did that. And he's saying, don't you dare forget who the real God is, who the real one in control of your life is. It's Yahweh, the God who delivered you from Egypt, and no other. Okay, well, what does that have to do with Jesus? So when we get to Jesus, here we've got this offer. Satan is saying, all I'm asking, I'm much better than God. I'm a much gooder being than your father. He's going to make you suffer. I won't make you suffer. All I'm asking is just, 10 seconds of respect here. But Jesus recognizes that nonetheless, even though Satan is presenting it as if it's this insignificant, trivial, empty, hollow, symbolic gesture on Jesus' part. I mean, I think I might add, Satan is whispering under his breath, you don't even need to mean it. So he's presenting it as this trivial, empty, hollow gesture. Nevertheless, Jesus realizes that in the context of the situation, what Satan is basically saying is, Jesus, let me be your benefactor. Let me be the one that you look upon as the giver of gifts to you, as the giver of authority to you, as the giver of glory to you. Let me be your benefactor. And Jesus is recognizing that would be wrong. That's exactly what Moses was warning Israel not to do. Don't you dare ever look upon any other being, any other will in the universe as your benefactor other than Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He's the only one who can be a benefactor. So if Jesus were to change his orientation and say yes to Satan, to the devil, and say, yes, I will let you be my benefactor, it would be to fail to fear the Lord his God. So he reminds himself of that by quoting Deuteronomy and rebuffs and rejects the devil's offer on the grounds that it would be to, in effect, see the devil as the true God. Okay, that's the passage. His goal in this passage, let me just analyze it very briefly and then I'll open up the question. His goal is the same as in the other one, to render Jesus unrighteous. His strategy is, we have to understand in the background, there's this suggestion that God is not good enough, and notice that he augments that suggestion here by subtly trying to point out, I'm better than God. I'm a gooder being than God because I don't make people suffer in order to give them the glory and that they desire. But your Father is making you suffer. He's suggesting that he can offer a superior alternative to the one that God is offering him. Glory through suffering is the Father's, glory without any suffering the devil is offering him. His deceptive suggestion is that Satan has the authority to grant Jesus his exalted destiny in another way, in a different way. Well, that's simply false. If he were to obey Satan and bow down and worship him, God could very easily have decided, you are disqualified by it to be my king, you are not going to have authority. And I think that's in part what Jesus recognizes. There's only one way that I can achieve my destiny, and that's the way that God has destined for me. And if that means suffering and death, then that will be suffering and death. Okay, what can we learn from this second temptation? First of all, that there is one and only one God means that there is one and only one benefactor, and we need to recognize that for our own lives. I must never neglect the truth that God and God alone controls the course of my life and experience, and hence he alone is my ultimate benefactor. Whatever blessing I long for, whatever need I want met, whatever sorrow I want comfort from, he alone is the one I must look to grant it. Jesus was fully embracing that truth, and we need to follow his example. I think there are a number of ways that we fail to heed that truth. Let me just mention those. When we think that other gods can supply the blessing that God has promised, because we're dissatisfied with the life and experience that God has granted us, we seek to better our own lives and experience by seeking other beneficiaries of the favors of other gods. The God of sex, the God of money, the God of power, the God of fame, the God of glory, and the list could go on. When we seek them to give us their blessings, we are neglecting the truth that Jesus was unwavering in holding on to. Now, the subtlety is, as I said, those other gods do exist. And we can seek their blessing. But what we have to understand is no other God can bless us unless the one and only true God wills it so. And that's the basis for Moses' exhortation. There's only one God who's truly God, who truly counts in the end. And we are being foolish if we think we can circumvent the sovereign will of God by seeking the blessings of some other God apart from that. There are many moments in our life when we are presented with the possibility of striking a bargain with the devil, if you will, and that devil comes in the form of these other gods. I will honor you as my benefactor. Bless me, is in effect what we say. I will obey you. I will serve you. I will do what you demand. Bless me. And that's the attitude of our heart toward many of these other gods. One of the most subtle ways, I think, in the Christian culture is when we think that the God of biblical principles has granted me success. Two examples. One thing that's always struck me odd is that within the Christian community, you will often have, you know, every decade or so, you have a Christian businessman go through town offering the seminars. And they have made a lot of money. They've been very successful in business. They're outstanding Christian leaders. And they will offer a seminar to share with you how it is that they were so successful financially. And the reason they were successful financially is because they put into practice the biblical principles that led them to success and led them to prosperity. And they, you know, by paying them $35, you can be led in on those principles as well. The thing that they fail to understand, and the thing that any of us who go to that seminar fail to understand, is if God had willed their failure, they would have failed. The only reason they succeeded as businessmen is because God willed their success as businessmen. The only reason the Israelites drank from those cisterns and ate the grapes out of those vineyards is because God willed that they drink from those cisterns and eat those grapes. The Canaanites would have kicked their butt if God had wanted them to. Their success was completely and totally a gift from God. Nothing more and nothing less. The same is true of us today. If I succeed in business, it's because God has willed my success. If I fail in business, it's because God has willed my failure. And it makes no difference whether I have applied biblical principles or not. All the application of biblical principles in the world is not going to circumvent the sovereign will of the only God who is God. Same with parenting. A parent who credits his obedience to biblical principles in parenting his kids, and who looks at the quality of his children and says, the reason that my children are such quality children is because I have obeyed biblical principles in my parenting. Again, garbage, I say. The only reason any human being becomes a quality human being, regardless of the parentage and regardless of the nurture that they receive, is because ultimately God has willed it so. There are no guarantees of outcomes in this life. The one who controls it is the sovereign will of God, who is telling whatever story he wants to tell and is scripting reality the way he wants to script reality. That's why he and he alone must be feared, because we cannot circumvent his will. All too often in Christian culture, we teach one another to follow other gods. In the name of Christianity, in the name of Jesus, to be sure, but what we in effect are saying to people is, never mind the will of God, make it come out differently anyway if you just do it this way. If you just apply these principles or act in this way or behave in this way, then we can get different results than what perhaps God has sovereignly willed. That's idolatrous. That's blasphemous. That's the very unbelief that Jesus avoided and that Moses was warning Israel about. Let's leave it there and take your questions or comments.
Now, I don't know if I want to do this now. Everybody's laughing at me. Okay. It seems to me that your last point could use some clarification.
Okay. I was counting on that.
Yeah. Maybe I don't need to ask my question. Maybe you should. You want to take a shot at clarifying it without my question?
No, go ahead.
All right. Well, I think I know what you're getting at, and what you're talking about is really important, I think, in that there is this kind of presumption that we can take on that somehow, I mean, in essence, it's very much like the attitude that the Pharisees had, that God approves of us because we know we've got these rules and we followed them, and our lives are going well because we've done these things. And to see someone like Paul in Romans 5 turn around and say that, in essence, you know, how God blesses you is by bringing trouble into your life so your faith can grow and you can see his work in your heart and that kind of thing. So all of those sorts of things support the point that you're making, I think. But I think, maybe you are saying, but I don't think you're saying, when we talk about following principles, I don't think you're denying that there are principles. There is a biblical worldview out of which I want to live. And that in general, it's true. I mean, my children are quite likely to come out worse if I'm a drug addict and I beat them and I sell them into prostitution than if I try to love them and seek their welfare and stuff like that. I mean,
you think?
Yes. Okay, so, I mean, that, what you just said could sound like a really stupid thing to say,
right,
if you don't make some distinctions.
Right.
Okay, so rather than me trying to make the distinctions, I'm inviting you to make those distinctions.
Yeah, I mean, biblical truth is biblical truth, and we ought to abide by and conform our lives to biblical truth anyway. What I'm taking issue with is the attitude that we often take that, oh, conformity to biblical truth is a guarantee of a certain outcome and a guarantee that certain expectations that we have are going to be met. And we actually encourage those expectations often in those sorts of seminars that I'm talking about. I mean, I've heard it, you know, baldly stated, if you simply obey these principles, basically, I will guarantee you that your children will grow up to be godly children. That's what I'm saying garbage to. But am I suggesting am I suggesting there is no right way to live? Not at all. I mean, there's a right way to live, and we ought to live it because it's the right way to live. And will it, in general terms, I mean, the whole point of the Proverbs is, I think, that generally speaking, the righteous are going to have a certain kind of safety and prosperity of a certain sort, generally speaking. And I do think we can count on that. We can count on, out of our obedience is going to come a much better way of being a human being in all respects, generally speaking. And I think we can go so far as to say, when it isn't an obviously better way to be, it's only because the will of the one who is the only one who counts has better things to do in my life, has another agenda, has higher priorities. And I think we can go so far as to say, I can't prove this from the Bible, but my sense is we don't suffer anything unless God in his sovereignty is wanting to use that for our betterment, for our everlasting betterment. I don't think there's any random suffering in our lives.
Okay, that's good. Because you said some really great stuff. And the last thing there, I just think it needed that clarification. Can I ask just one little teeny more question? At the beginning, it's not a big deal, but it would be interesting to know, I'm sure that people here know that you tend to do this kind of thing a lot. And it would be interesting to see into the workings of your mind. How did you get to this spot? At the beginning, when you're talking about Satan taking him up on the mountain, your conclusion that he's not somehow supernaturally showing him what all the kingdoms of the world,
okay,
but he's getting him up high and saying there's a lot of Rome out there. How is it that you decided? I mean, I don't have any problem with that,
right,
but I don't have any problem with the other either. So how did you decide that one was better than the other?
Because he took him up on a high mountain. If it's a PowerPoint presentation, any old classroom will do. What's the significance of a high mountain, it seems to me, is that you can see unobstructed the vastness of the horizon. So the fact that he took him up on a high mountain is suggesting to me the substance of what it is that he's showing him.
When Satan offers him the world, if you just, you know, bow down. Now, some people see that as Darth Vader and Luke, you know, come, we will rule the universe together.
Right. Exactly, yeah.
But if I'm sitting there watching this exchange, I'm going, don't do it, Jesus, because once you bow down to him, he's top dog. So you'll never rule the world. You'll only serve him. So it seems like a self-defeating offer. It's that, like, you come work for me and you can run my company. You'll be top dog. And the guy goes, no, I won't. I'll work for you. See what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Not the apprentice.
Yeah. Maybe I'm wrong, but I'm not looking at it quite that way, because the words he uses is that he's going to hand, I have been granted this authority and I will hand it over to you. I mean, the claim is actually that, okay, I will relinquish my position of power and you will have my position of power. I'm just asking this one silly little thing of you. Now, maybe I'm wrong about that, but there's a germ of truth in what you're saying, and that's what Jesus grasps, is that I am nevertheless having to make you my benefactor. And even if the authority is completely handed over such that after the fact he's not the devil's slave, nonetheless, the devil has been permanently rendered his benefactor in that process. And that's the very thing that Jesus says, I can't do that. I'm unwavering in my commitment to recognize the godness of God, that he and he alone is the only benefactor in all of reality. So in that sense, Satan would remain the top dog in the way that I'm looking at it.
So Jesus is saying, if God wants me to have this, I'll get it.
Right.
I don't need to demean myself. And if God doesn't want me to have it, I shouldn't want it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if it doesn't come from God, I shouldn't be wanting it. I mean, that's partly what we learned in the first temptation as his attitude. If God doesn't want me to have it for some reason, then I shouldn't be having it anyway. So I'm either going to get it from him or not at all, but I'm not getting it from you.
So he's kind of like, is he playing on that old theme of, if you just do one wrong thing, you get all the right things?
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of an analogy, but there's a famous writer once wrote that if I came to you and said, I can heal the world if you just murder this child, would you be willing to do it? And Jesus is kind of saying, it is not worth doing that,
right,
even to heal the world.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the purity of his commitment is truly astonishing when you stop to think about it. I mean, who of us wouldn't be caught in the utility of just this one little sin, just this one little act of disobedience, and I can have so much good? And yet, from his perspective, is no.
Okay.
To disobey God is never right, is never worth it. Daniel?
Well, but going back to this thing that you and Ron are talking about, the idea of living the right life and how we all know certain things come out in certain ways. But would you also say, or do you think part of this passage is talking about that desire to live that righteous way is the will of God in and of itself? Because I see this really subtle slip over that we sometimes do in culture in general, Christian culture included. We begin to think, well, yeah, it's really me. You know, I'm a smarty smart guy. I see that if I do all these things, my kids are going to come out okay. My business is going to be great. But isn't that desire born of the Father himself? Or
it is. I would ultimately, as you know, argue that it is. But I don't think that's in view here. In this passage, I think we're seeing Jesus in his freedom, in the freedom of his will, resolving to be unwaveringly committed to truth and to reject the lies and the falsehood. And God's sovereignty over his own choices is not really in view here. I believe it, but I think we'd have to go to other passages to look at that.
Yeah, not to beat a dead horse, but I just wanted to revisit that last point you made again. It seems to me that you have opened up that whole controversial can of worms over the predestination versus free will argument. I've never been able myself to wrap my mind around that whole concept. It seems very innately paradoxical, you know, if I'm successful or a failure and God ordains that and micromanages every last detail by himself, why should I seek to do anything if it's automatically going to come out the way he wants it to? You know, would you care to share? Is that possible to even put in a nutshell?
Okay. I'm almost done editing my book on that subject. That's 275 pages. I don't want to, it's not a very good book. So I don't want to, you know, I don't want to promise anything. It's not a very good book, but I think my ideas are right. And I think my arguments are right. And what I'm trying to argue in that book is that I am just as free as I think I am. I am just as free as I have ever experienced myself being. Free will is a reality. It's not an illusion. It's a reality. On the one hand. On the other hand, it is equally true that God is the sovereign author of every detail of every nanosecond of existence. And my argument is those are utterly and completely compatible, but understanding how they are compatible takes a little thought. And that's what I've tried to explore in my book. So I'd be glad to talk further with any of you that want to and try to spell out the arguments, but we're running out of time here and I can't go over 275 pages right now. So
I don't know if you're familiar with the interpretation of the temptations that Dostoevsky puts forward in Brothers
Karamazov. Actually, I'm not. Yeah.
Okay. Well.
I will be shortly.
It strikes me that, and you're drawing a lot of that aspect out, is that these temptations are infinitely complex. Like, I mean, and I was trying to lay out the different consequences of the temptations, like the different attractiveness of the temptations. And you really, I think there's two things. I mean, Dostoevsky pretty much takes it in a very social aspect when the devil offers, when the devil turned this bread into stone, Dostoevsky takes that as like, Jesus can feed the world. Like, that's the aspect, that's the aspect of that temptation that Dostoevsky is pulling out of. And when he offers him the world, he's saying, you know, you can set yourself up as a noble ruler and rule justly. And like, and I like those things, but I mean, something that Dostoevsky hasn't done that I really, really like what you're doing is this kind of dual temptation of not only Jesus as a person. I mean, Jesus as a existential choosing like individual who doesn't really, I mean, not that he doesn't have an understanding of his place in history, but who is growing into his place in history. I mean, he's an individual who is learning who he is and experiencing what he's experiencing, and as this is another defining point in his own life curriculum. Like, I really like that you're bringing that out. And thirdly, which is I think ultimately, or secondly, I can't really remember. There's another point in my mind that I'm not going to bother you with, but I just skipped it. I also like that Jesus. Yes, these temptations seem to be complex, but that you're almost ultimately claiming, or at least putting forward, that Jesus' response is always, but if God wanted it another way, I wouldn't have this power. Like, you're right. Like, I mean, that's what I think is interesting. It's like the temptations themselves are infinitely complex, but you seem, and I think you're right, and I want to think about it more, but so far it's really, really interesting that Jesus comes back with pretty much the same response. Like I am this way because God orchestrated it, not because of anything I am. Like I don't know how that's complex. That's a paradoxical thing, but I mean, I could turn those things into bread because God allowed me to, and if he didn't, then I couldn't, kind of thing. Like, I really like that. Mm-hmm. And I also like to think that it's pretty, I mean, we think of the big three after World War II, you know, Stalin and Churchill and, you know, Roosevelt all hanging out and, like, you know, how big that is in history. I mean, like, this is huge.
Yeah,
like, this is amazing. Like,
yeah.
I mean, you have the Prince of Darkness and the most important existential choosing human in the whole world.
Yeah.
And they just happen to end up in the desert together hanging out. Like, that's just absolutely fascinating. Like, that's really interesting. So.
Yeah, that, thank you. I haven't emphasized that point, but I think it's really true. This is an incredibly poignant moment. I mean, Jesus is our hero here because he's the one who proved himself qualified to be the hero and champion and king over the whole universe right here at this moment in history. So, yeah, this is just dripping with significance.
Based on your comment that you've already dealt with, mostly the parenting issue, but putting that together with the temptation last week, I'm wondering, it would be really easy to come away with kind of a fatalistic attitude towards life. Here you have, in last week's temptation, you have Jesus who's very hungry, and he's tempted with turning the stones into bread, and he chooses not to, righteously so. I guess the question is, I guess it's a comment, I don't know. How do we tell when we can do something about that, when we ought to do something or ought not to do something about that? I mean.
Okay, yeah. Good question. Yeah. We could take the perspective, it's all in God's hands, I'm going to be utterly and completely passive and not do anything. But that, I don't think that's what Jesus' attitude is, and I don't think that should be our attitude. Notice that this is really all about the orientation of the heart, I think, in the end. It's not so much what we do as why we're doing it and out of what sort of orientation are we doing it. If I'm in a situation where I've got a problem and there seems to be some rational solution, I shouldn't go, oh, I've got this problem by the will of God, I need to leave it alone. There's absolutely nothing wrong with taking the reason that God gave me and using my rationality to try to solve the problems of my life. Where we see our orientation is what happens when God thwarts us. What happens when my rational solution doesn't work? And God seems intent on keeping me here and not allowing me to be able to find any solutions. Well, then I respond in one of two ways. Either with a kind of panic, and I frantically go looking for any and every solution I can, even the non-rational ones, because the last thing in the world I'm going to do is settle for this. Or we recognize in the inescapable will of God that God has me here, and I go, God, your will be done. You know, so be it. And it's that heart attitude that is at the heart of what this passage is all about, I think. It's not about what we do. I mean, we can make mistakes in what we do. We can make, you know, we can take action that really we shouldn't be taking. But if our heart attitude is right, I don't think we're really committing the sin that the devil is seeking to get Jesus to commit. The evil, the sin, would be the minute he gets Jesus thinking in a particular way, looking at God in a particular way, and looking at his situation in a particular way. What he acts on is almost immaterial at that point. He's already made him unrighteous because he's already got him to embrace a lie. And that's what we need to work on, is that we not embrace a lie. So anyway, we don't need to be passive. We can be proactive in trying to solve our problems, but always out of and from the framework of the kind of orientation that Jesus is modeling for us here. I need to let you go. Thank you.